Okay, this hour we'll take your phone calls here on Coast to Coast AM with Peter Ward as we talk about high sci-fi, high technology, super soldiers. Your questions next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. Our final hour here with Peter Ward. Peter, what would you say is the biggest downside of this genetic engineering of humans?
Well, the downside, too, is that, once again, my fear is that we will be able to, in the near future, genetically engineer better kids. So that the thing is, what my fear is, the better kids are going to be available to those with the money to pay for the better kids. And I'm a father. You always want your kids to be smart and healthy and tall and handsome and everything that...
And healthy.
Yes, and especially healthy. But again, this is going to be something that's going to cost. It's not something that's going to be available to everyone. And so, it, once again, I'm afraid it becomes almost something like, in a bad example, I guess, cosmetic surgery. That's a very pricey thing. Insurance doesn't pay for it. And people who can afford it quite often do it. I mean, not everybody. But nevertheless, think of it as cosmetic surgery. But in this particular case, you're doing the surgery on the kids you're going to have. So that, to me, it becomes a very undemocratic and a very sort of nasty way that we increase the influence of wealth, not just anymore on where we live or how we live or the toys we have, but on the children we produce.
Isn't this a little weird? Doesn't this remind you a little bit of Joseph Mengele and the Nazis during World War II?
Well, you know, it's funny you say that, is that the headline came out in the New York Times today about this Epstein character who really was into eugenics. And Mengele and the Nazis had this process. Eugenics was where they wanted to breed the superhumans. They wanted the good German blonde youths to breed with the good German blonde women to make better and better young Germans. And so this is where you would cull out, just like you tried to raise your own breed of dog. That's a nasty, awful, terrible, inhuman process. And yet we're looking at something that's a variety of it almost, called transhumanism, where now what we're trying to do is make better humans by adding perhaps machinery parts or this or that. But the transhumanism is something that would happen to one person and not get passed on. The problem with the genetic stuff is that if we can make a new gene, make a new human, and then those genes get passed on, then we really are playing God. And it becomes, unfortunately, what is the God of money? Is it Babel? I mean, now we're starting to see the influence of enormous wealth.
And what happens to the people who don't cut the muster, who don't live up to the standards that would have been created with these super people? What do we do with these people? Are we going to extinguish them? What will happen to them?
Not so much extinguish, but fall behind. And there was a wonderful movie, what, 10 or 15 years ago, it's always longer than I thought, called Gattaca. It was Ethan Hawke was a kid who just didn't have the right genes, and he still wanted to be an astronaut and go in space. And he went to all the ends of the Earth to try to fake his genes. But in some way, even the college scandals, you know, the college cheating scandals that we're seeing now, where parents will do anything, including cheat and pay tons of money to get their kids into college, isn't it just one more step that the parents who can afford that would not just do anything, but actually make the medical changes so that those kids have every single advantage beyond just the wealth and fame of the parents?
I think we're going to create the island of Dr. Moreau. We're going to create, something's going to go wrong here, Peter.
Well, it depends on which version, because there have been many, as you know. I think Marlon Brando, Dr. Moreau once, and there was, anyway, yes, it's a scary Wells, H.G. Wells type of approach. And, it's always nasty when a scientist, an older scientist like me, says, you know, beware, be careful of what science can do. Frankenstein is a very useful story, and it is something to be afraid of. We should attempt to embrace the great, the good that could happen from this, but we should also be able to police it. And again, I'm going back, this is my fear. Who is policing the geneticists right now?
Nobody.
Uh-huh. I went to a TED talk. I was able to give a TED talk in 2008, and Craig Venter, the person who actually did the first human genome project, was there. And he was What an egotist. He was going on about how his new company or his company was able to produce really the first alien. They produced human life, or not human life, Earth life, but they added in a new type of amino acid. We have the same 20 amino acids. He built a living cell with a 21st amino acid, and that becomes really technically not Earth life.
Hmm.
I asked the question for the audience. I said, well, look, if you can put a new amino acid in here, that opens a whole new pathway for building a particular type of toxin, or especially a biological agent that an immune system won't see. It would become blind to our immune systems. And he laughed at me and he said, defense would always catch up. I guess he's never studied warfare.
That's right.
Defense, we'd catch up, we'd figure it out, we'd get a cure soon enough. Well, not if you have a fast-moving toxin that kills hundreds of millions of people in the first few days. Good luck getting your defense and getting them back to life. So, yeah, it is scarier than I think the atomic age now, because, again, so many people are now can get into and have access because the chemicals and the material isn't expensive. It's not like building a nuclear reactor. It's not like getting uranium. I mean, we're talking about cells. There's cells all around us. Chemicals, manipulation, the right set of viruses, the right set of equipment, and many people could do this.
Let's have a great experience with our callers, Peter. Here's first-time caller Tim in Johnson City, Tennessee. Good morning, Timmy. Go ahead.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I was just curious as if he's ever heard of a company called Neuralink. It's, I guess, founded by Elon Musk, where they're actually inserting probes into the brain. They're supposed to start taking human people next year for this, kind of merging. What they do is they insert the probes and they record the brain activity, the electronics of the brain, and merge it with AI to increase intelligence, supposedly help with Alzheimer's and artificial limbs and this type of thing.
That's an interesting type concept.
But I've also heard part of what they're trying to do, and Musk is trying to do, is they're searching for a way to preserve memories, to hatch. What is a memory? I mean, this is one of the oddest, most difficult things for science to understand. You learn something changes in your brain, but is it only electrical? No, there appears to be protein changes. There's something there that wasn't there before that has a physical manifestation. So Musk and others are trying to figure out if there's any way that they could record memories and then pull it out of a creature, a body. It could be a lower creature or it could be us. And again, science is a beautiful thing. Who knows what good could come of this? And again, we have to hope that it is good that comes of us.
Well, listen to this concept, Peter. The great baseball player Ted Williams, you heard of him, of course. When he died, his head has been severed. It's at a company that practices cryogenics. It's frozen. And their hope one day is to be able to do exactly what Musk is trying to do, and that's record and download memory and then insert it into a clone body. So what you have then, if you're able to do that, and they can download Ted Williams' memory, because you are your memory, and then insert it into a clone body of Ted Williams, a younger version, he lives forever.
Well, he does, but I read a very funny dark science fiction story that played on that theme, where many people get their heads cut off and put in here. And then 300, 400 years later, the technology comes along where they can bring these back to life. But at that time, what they do with those brains and those consciousnesses is load them in lawnmowers or baggage trains or cleaning bots, anything that needs a brain to do the menial work. So imagine he comes back now as a baseball player, but the brain of a lawnmower, which cuts all the ballpark lawns, maybe give me a belly laugh, that idea.
That's conceivable. You're right, because after 300 or 400 years, things have changed so much, you won't even know what's going on.
Well, there you you go. And the other thing is, just by that time, maybe brains, artificial brains, AI is so cheap that, yeah, they bring it back, but they're just going to use it for menial, trivial things.
I mean, can you imagine if you dump somebody from the 1600s into our time zone right now? He'd freak out.
Well, yes, and I think we would freak out back. It would be an interesting experience.
Let's go to Dennis in California. Welcome to the show. Hi, Denny. Go ahead.
Hi. I was just kind of curious in sort of training up or preparing these super soldiers, to what degree is the violent videos and stuff, is that part of preparing and sort of recruiting for military? Is that a preparatory work?
You know, that's a good question. There's no question. Some of these video games, maybe a lot of them, are violent video games, Peter. Are they being done on purpose for the masses?
I can't speak to that because that's sort of going conspiracy. I can't say it's not true. I'm a pretty good scientist. I'm never going to say something is impossible. But what I can say to them, and what I've tried to point out in this book of mine from last year, is that what the violent video games have done to us is desensitize us to the hideous violence. And I've listed the 10 most violent games in my book and asking, if you see over and over and over that level of violence, what is the long-term biological effect on the person looking at it? And this being desensitized, when we see these, you know, it goes through my mind, we see these school kids come in and kill other school kids. You wonder, how in the world was that person that broken? And yet the society now seems to revere ultraviolence in a way that would have shocked the 1950s. I mean, my generation, my parents' generation, they would be appalled by the level of violence you could even see on TV. Things change, but our brains don't change as quickly as society does. I think we are still cavemen in many respects, and violence has always been horrific, and that I think we have desensitized ourselves to the point that we are creating changes. Now, whether the soldiers are trained for violence, I don't know. I wasn't in the military. But I do know that you can certainly start looking at behaviors that would be of advantage if you wanted a really ferocious trained killer that may not be societally polite for the rest of the world.
Let's go to Bill, state of Washington. Hey, Bill, go ahead.
Yeah, hey, just based on the subject matter, I want to get your take on the concept of panspermia. You know, with what we've come up with in modern science, we can detect the precursors of life in other solar systems, like mm-hmm. hydroxylamine and also helium hydride can be detected. And, you know, we sent Bacillus subtilis up into the, up into space. It can go into a spore. I mean, that's one of the most common bacteria on the Earth. I mean, it's in grass.
Yep.
You know, I was wondering if you have any thoughts on panspermia, that life here was actually seeded from, somewhere else.
I have a lot of thoughts about it. My co-author of my book, A New History of Life, came out in 2015, is Dr. Joseph Kirschfink. And Kirschfink from Caltech is one of the leading proponents of panspermia. He was studying the Mars meteorite that was ALH. This is the meteorite that was found on ice that he says, and other scientists said, and many of NASA scientists said, showed tiny little bits of bacteria in it. So NASA and many people started asking, well, how could a rock with bacteria in it re-enter the Earth and not burn up and burn them up? So they did some really cool experiments. They took some great big hunks of basalt, big pieces of rock, that were impregnated with lots of bacteria right in the middle of the basalt, and pasted them on the front of one of the Russian Cosmo, one of the little capsules that they keep sending.
Exactly.
Yeah, and they blasted this thing back down to Earth and took the rock off, and I'll be darned, those bacteria deep inside were still alive.
They survived.
They did. So if you have a big enough meteorite hit a planet, it throws stuff into space. I guarantee there are pieces of T-Rex on the moon, and they were blasted there when the Chicxulub asteroid hit our planet. A whole bunch of that crater didn't just go ballistic. It went out of the Earth's gravity. gravity and into space, and it landed on all kinds of places. Yes, we have tons of Mars rock. Kirschfink says that early Earth would not have been conducive for the formation of the first life that Mars was. And so, therefore, we're Martians.
Peter, as an astrobiologist, can you explain the Big Bang?
No.
Perfect. That's the best answer I've ever heard.
And more than that, it gives me a headache to start thinking, because then you start saying, well, what happened before it?
And exactly.
I just break down. I don't get parallel universes. I don't understand string theory. I'm a pretty simple geologist, and I'm just kind of, I try and I recognize my brain just does not expand that much to figure that part out.
I just can't get beyond the what happened before. I can't.
Me too. This is the one that I keep running up against. It's like a brick wall.
I do not accept you that this all came from nothing. I just can't comprehend it.
You and I must have been hatched from the same egg, George, because I'm right there with you. It just makes no sense.
There were many nights I would sit in my room as a teenager wondering that very question. And I would talk with Mom, who's she's still 90, Peter, and checks in on the show quite often.
Congratulations.
She would always tell me, like I said, Mom, who started God? How did God get here in the first place? And her simple answer always was, always will be. And for her, that was it. And there's no other answer for that. And
That's as good as anything I've ever heard.
I know, but I kept telling her, Mom, that's unacceptable to me. It always was, always will be. I need to know how it started. And nobody has this answer. And I'm not sure, Peter, we'll ever get that answer. Ever.
No, I do know one last thing of panspermia. All through my professional days, it was recognized that, yes, you could have life going from planet to planet, but that it would never happen between stars because the distance were too great and everything else. But, you know, George, we had that strange thing that people thought was an alien craft a year ago that went flying through the solar system. Its name, Onomatopoeia.
It's still out there somewhere. They think it was artificial.
Yeah,
I think it's an asteroid, but who knows?
But it came from another solar system.
Yep.
This is where you could have bacteria just don't die. You entomb them in rock. We were able to bring back to life, not me, but other paleontologists from Permian-age rocks. 250-million-year-old salt crystals were thawed out. They broke them open, and they found living bacteria 250 million years old. This was plenty of time to go between systems. You know, these asteroids could be taking life from place to place.
What excites you the most of your work, Peter?
Increasingly, I'm getting into more and more conservation. I've worked on ancient Cretaceous animals from the age of dinosaurs, but I've been studying the chambered nautilus, which is a really cool animal, 500 million years old. What lets something survive all the great catastrophes? And finally, I was able to get the United States to put it as endangered species, and the global government through CITES to stop the shell trade. It's just a massacre in the Indo-Pacific, George, and the Atlantic, when people go out and get these seashells, and they're so pretty, and they wipe out all the species. But the nautilus is especially being wiped out. This is an animal, the shell, you can find it in any shell shop, in most bathrooms, that beautiful spiral, they're up to 100 years old.
That's amazing.
For a dollar. It's a crime.
All right, Peter, stay with us. We're going to come back with final phone calls for you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Take a look at all of Peter's books on his website, which is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Next hour, we're going to be talking about the Great Flood. And also, our guest is an expert in cannabis, so we'll talk a little bit about that, too. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Peter Ward, our special guest, our final segment as we talk about superhumans. And explain CRISPR again for us, Peter, if you would.
Yeah, CRISPR is a technique where a geneticist can insert one gene. So a gene, of course, could produce a protein, or in some cases we think genes can certainly influence behavior. But mostly they build a protein, and that protein itself might be part of a cell wall, but it also might be something that helps you see. It could be something that makes you smarter. So in some cases, single proteins, single genes can actually really dictate major consequences for an animal. And so What the Chinese did is take this CRISPR, and again, it's just a tiny way of putting a little slice of DNA, just a little segment of DNA, into an already present living creature. It gets sliced into a spot along a long DNA strand, a chromosome, and begins to work. So you have put in a working bit of biology that was not there before. What the Chinese did is find a gene that helps produce big muscles, and they put it into dogs. And, I mean, these silly beagles are enormously muscular, and they, to make the point, the skinniest of all dogs that I know of is called a whippet. We even use that term for describing something skinny. The whippet has gigantic muscles. I called it Arnold Schwarzenegger Whippets.
On steroids.
It's just the funniest, silly-looking thing, except the consequences and what it means are not silly at all.
How many genes does the human body possess?
Somewhere like 30 or 40,000. It's not all that many because it isn't one gene for one biological thing that happens. Genes can turn on big clusters of areas of the body. There are controller genes that consequently move other genes to do this or that. I mean, when you think about how a human body is formed, it's much like you build a house. You're the general contractor. You've got to bring in the workers, but you also have to bring in the materials at a given time and place. You're not going to build a roof before the frame is up. So building a body is really a dance of bringing material to the right place, having the right workers. So there are genes that control all of that. There are genes that are very simple, just telling you what type of fingernail you have or what material your bone is made of. But the Chinese found a gene, a single gene, that can increase the muscles in a mammal. We are mammals.
Interesting take. Now, what happens if you change 100 genes? Do you really change the complexity of a human being?
Well, I mean, one of the interesting things about, for instance, people say, why can't we very quickly increase intelligence? Intelligence is coded on many, many genes. In fact, there are at least the estimate used to be there were 400 separate genes that all interact to produce the intelligence that we have. So CRISPR can only put in one at a time, so you're certainly not going to make anybody very much smarter not being able to mess with all 400 genes. So CRISPR is something where you look for systems that only a small number of genes have large consequences. But look, CRISPR is the first step out of the gate. You know, George, there's going to be...
There'll be more.
Way more, and that is where it's going.
Let's go to Paul in Boston, Mass. Hey, Paul, go ahead, sir.
Good morning, George.
Hi, Paul.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
In regards to this fooling around with the genes and stuff, I was in the Guards from 52 to 62, and I had two helicopters. I was a section chief on two helicopters. And for every hour that they fly, you got 2 hours of maintenance. So I didn't have much time on my own when we went on maneuvers. And they started something. In the morning, you take your, you know, you go through the chow line, but the cereal was unmarked, and they'd give you a box of cereal, you know, the small ones you open up, put the milk in.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I got one of the lucky packs that had something in it. And for 3 days, I was like, you know, every morning you get the cereal. And for 3 days, I had like roller skates with jets on them. There was nothing I couldn't do or be any place, anytime, do everything myself.
You got the super cereal somehow.
Two packs a day, I was three packs.
Huh.
Instead of drinking 3 bottles of Coca-Cola during the day, I was up to 6 or 7.
Jeez, that's too much.
But on the third afternoon, that was it. The back muscles and the leg muscles went. I had to go down to the tent. They couldn't wake me up. They took me at the clinic. And they said, oh, my. You know, I woke up, I had stuff on my arms, and they were giving me dextrose and some other stuff.
What happened to you?
Well, they had put some type of steroid or some something in...
In the cereal?
The cereal. Who, and this was...
Who did that?
The Army doing this. It was... pressure up above from the CIA.
They were testing you.
They were testing so many different guys got it.
Well, you know, it is true that those in some kind of secret form of government, Peter, in the 1950s, for example, would test biologicals on our sailors. They even sprayed part of St. Louis to test it to see what the effects would be. I mean, that's almost like dabbling today with what they're doing with CRISPR.
Yeah, there was way worse things, too. We know, George, that the military was certainly doing some very nasty things. Look, I live in Washington State, and we have a bunch of poor people called the downwinders. When the Hanford radiation-producing complex released a whole bunch of radiation that blew all the way over to Spokane, Washington,
Gosh. And
the Army never told anybody that this had happened. No one could get inside, get away, and it just... Yes, the Cold War was a rotten, miserable, awful time, and an individual human really didn't have a lot of value when our government thought that we were in very much close to a shooting war.
Let's go to Wayne in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Wayne, go ahead.
Good evening, gentlemen. Sir Greg.
Hello there.
I got a couple of comments, first of all, on the head thing, the frozen head thing. I've actually got a relative that's had that done to them. I had a friend at the University of Oregon Health Science Center that worked in this area for over 30 years in trying to regenerate life from frozen bugs, lower species than that. And he said it's impossible. He says once that cell is frozen in the body and it splits, it's like a nuclear explosion. Hmm. It's the only way they can possibly extend life like that, mammal life, is to keep the body temperature at like 31.5 degrees or 32.5 degrees, I guess it would be, just a half degree below, you know, above freezing, because once you freeze it, it's gone.
Interesting.
Yeah, you know. Water turns to ice, and when ice it breaks. But I think a better way to do it is if you remove all the water out of the creature, the head, and put in antifreeze, and then it will never bust up in that way. We're thinking about other kinds of life, say, far out in space, because the problem with very cold planets or moons like Titan, any sort of life there that is based on our water type of life is going to freeze. And you're right. Ice breaks up cells and kills it and destroys it. But you don't have to have just water for the interior of a cell. I mean, we could see ammonia-based life. And I think one of the ideas about the freezing is you get the water out as quickly because, yes, you're totally right. Once you freeze it, once that ice breaks in there, every bit of the cells are destroyed. And you're right. It's like going through a bomb. But it doesn't say science won't keep trying.
Let's go back to you, Wayne. You had a question? Go ahead.
Yeah, Peter, thank you. My question is on exoplanets. And, the latest figure I could see on the Internet was 2017. They said 100 billion stars, and I heard a figure this year over the radio, 350 billion stars. They think there's an average of 30 planets per star. That would be, I think, over 30 trillion planets, a number of them in the habitable life zones on those stars. What's your take on the possibility of extraterrestrials?
And that's the Drake equation, Peter.
Yeah, there's just the numbers are so enormous that, again, I just cannot imagine that we are alone. It's just the odds are way too low. Just the fact, look, one of the coolest things that we know from the fossil record is that life appeared on this planet almost as soon as it could have. And the implication is it's not that hard to build a bacterium from first scraps, and then especially if we have meteorites going from moon to moon or from planet to planet and spreading life, then you have much more life. The bad news is the Fermi paradox. Where is everybody? And so this is where our conversation earlier about the UFOs, I find it fascinating. Is there an uptick, or are we seeing something new, or are we having mass delusion from too much stress? So it's an interesting time to be alive. Our instruments are so much better that if there are other people out there, other creatures out there, I think we're going to run into them sooner or later.
Let's go to Shingletown, California. Roger's there. Hey, Rog, go ahead.
Yeah, how are you doing, George?
Great. Thanks.
I lived in Alaska for many, many years, and I lived in the villages up there. And In 1990, I guess it was 97 or so, we had some people come into the village and ask to exhume a couple graves, and the family actually said it was okay. And they exhumed the graves and took microorganisms from the Spanish flu epidemic that devastated northwestern Alaska. They took vials of some of that genetic material, and I've often wondered whatever happened to that. And why those people were there doing that, but you know the where we're at right now, you know, 20 or 30 years later, is the fact that they're doing genetic splicing with the viruses, and you know, it's just a matter of time till some crazy gets a hold of a virus and something into it, where like Ebola becomes highly contagious or something of that nature. Do you think you could speak to that when you were discussing the gene splicing? I think it's a whole different level on viruses.
Go ahead, Peter.
Yeah, well, viruses have genes too. There's two types of viruses. They have DNA like we do, or they have RNA, which is, we have that too, and we use both of them. They are composed of many genes, and they put their genes into other organisms. I mean, that's what a virus does. It's like a mosquito. In reverse, it, instead of sucking blood out, it pushes its fluids in, and those genes are the machinery to turn that cell into a virus factory. So the new genes say build viruses instead of whatever you did. And of course, when a cell starts building viruses, it kills the cell from doing what it did, and that's why a virus disease can kill us. Too many of the viruses are now being produced by cells that used to be good for, like, blood cells or breathing or all the things that go on. But you're right. Look, it's just like, it's almost the same argument we just said about life in space. There are just too many stars for there not to be. And there are, unfortunately, too many biologists now out there who have the technique and the ability to weaponize, to think that they'll all be perfectly sane forever and they'll never turn into the equivalent of a Las Vegas shooter, but with an immeasurably bigger gun.
Joe in Long Island, New York. Take it away, Joseph.
Yeah, hi. Pete, you know, ancient Rome, ancient Greece, Egypt were competitive societies based on physicality. Do you think they dabbled in this stuff or tried to in some way? And also, wouldn't you say the caveman is a myth? I mean, there just aren't that many caves. So can we blame our behavior, road rage, on being former cavemen when they're... It's like half a continent without a single cave.
You know, I'm guilty as charged. Although, it seems to me, my little quick brain is telling me that perhaps if we think about prehistoric humans, some of the most highly evolved of all were those that painted in those caves. I mean, some of the great art ever is from the 30,000-year-old caves, and they were definitely cavemen and cavewomen, some of the greatest artists ever. But I take your point, and I'll take it all back. And as they say now, we know we're all at least 5% Neanderthal based on new genetic studies. So that was my Neanderthal moment.
And let's get a quick final call from Archer in Hawaii. Hi, Arch. Go ahead.
Hi, gentlemen. Thank you very much for welcoming me aboard here.
Thank you.
Peter, I'd like to know your response to this. In 1954, as a freshman at Dartmouth College, I took a course in psychology 101, by which time, fully integrated with that program, 1954, was a film that had been made over years. And this, previous to that, and this had been, this pertains to the stress that humans are feeling at the moment. Basically, they created a paradise, a country club for rats. And rats are these beautifully mammalian creatures that have, they could take great pride in their environment. They had unlimited food, unlimited space, entertainment, places to run, hide, do all the things that rats love to do.
Hmm.
So we watched this over the years of its unfolding. This is already years before 1954, and the net result was that generation after generation, they thrived in this wonderful environment, unlimited food, water, everything, until there were more and more and more, to the point where their entire social structure began to disintegrate completely, and that's how it ended.
Sounds like us, doesn't it, Archer?
Well, I'm wondering, what do you think?
30 seconds left. Go for it, Peter.
That seems like a great way to end this show. you know, it's just we use those rats for so many things. But societies come and societies go. And I think going back to Rome and Greece, those societies are absolutely gone. So we are in a system now where I just hope that technology is not what's driving us through this ever greater stress. The machines that are supposed to make life better for us, you know, you wonder. And I am a child of the 20th century, and I'm just watching the 21st with some amusement.
Peter, you're always welcome back to the program. Thank you so much. All his information linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Up next, the Great Flood, and also a little bit about why are states approving marijuana?